From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The Trump administration last Friday announced that the United States would stop the refueling of Saudi warplanes used in the brutal years-long war in Yemen. The move came after months of pressure over mounting civilian casualties in the Gulf Arab's poorest nation and a United Nations warning of a catastrophic famine. The apparent American slap on the wrist is also a response to the brutal Saudi killing of dissident Jamal Khashoggi. But critics point out that the move will do little to stop the Saudis. Saudi Arabia has led a massive air and ground assault on the Yemeni port city of Hodeidah just days after the U.S. called for a ceasefire. The latest reports on Monday from that assault claim that 149 people have been killed in just 24 hours, and that number includes civilians. There have been about 600 deaths since the assault on Hodeidah began on November 1st. My guest is Isa Bloomi. He's an associate professor in the Department of Asian, Middle Eastern, and Turkish Studies at Stockholm University. He's the author of Ottoman Refugees, 1878 to 1939, Foundations of Modernity, and Reinstating the Ottomans. His latest book is called Destroying Yemen, What Chaos in Arabia Tells Us About the World. We had him on our program about that book. He joins us once more on the program to give us the latest on the Yemen war. Welcome back to the show, Isa.
Thank you for having me, Sonali.
So this particular offensive in the port city of Hodeidah, what is significant about it? Why has it become such a flashpoint in this war?
Well, Hodeidah is really the only functioning port that has the capacity to incorporate and allow big ships to deliver food supplies, which unfortunately for the mass majority of the people of Yemen who live in the northern part of the country are now entirely dependent on those supplies. And since there is an embargo on the entirety of Yemen and all transport in and out of Yemen has to go through the so-called coalition's very tight-knit filter, if you will, of making sure that only certain kinds of products enter into the country. This means that controlling Hodeidah itself for Saudi interests, Saudi and an American alliance, would mean that they have absolute control over the fate of 18 million people who live in northern Yemen.
The famine is an added aspect of the war, very much, of course, related to the war. What has the United Nations warned us about this famine? We know that Yemen has been at risk of starvation for a long time, and there have been pockets of it where people have really struggled and suffered from starvation, especially children. You see heartbreaking photos of rail-thin children. But what's the latest on the famine?
Firstly, it's important to highlight to your audience that the UN has long provided cover for this operation, consistently suppressing the actual numbers of civilian deaths, keeping the number under 10,000 for the last 3 years, which is an outrage, according to many international organizations, especially the Norwegian organization that has really been the only voice in the West speaking out against this war consistently. And they've also suppressed the fact that people have starved to death. We don't have the numbers. It's impossible for us to tell. But since this war began in March of 2015, the first targets have been infrastructure, have been food storage facilities, food production facilities. Farms have been rendered useless with cluster bombs. So people from March 2015, in a country that was already dependent by 90% of food imports, was starving or was actually being targeted for starvation. So we actually do not know how many thousands, tens of thousands of children and young people and poor people have died because of starvation so far. But now that it's become such an obvious crisis that it's even become something that the Western media is covering more vigilantly, means that we are really facing a catastrophe. And unfortunately, we don't know the actual details because our sources are just not providing us an honest story, if you will.
Would you say then that hunger has become a weapon of war?
It has, again, the target from the day one was to undermine the ability of Yemenis to feed themselves. The fact that they could not capture Hodeidah port until today means that, does not mean that they have not been trying to capture that port. And whilst they've blocked all air traffic, they've made it impossible for people, 18 to 20 million people, to have access to the outside world without passing through this embargo, the fact that now they're actually trying to capture that only port which, even in the most difficult of times, has to be providing food supplies, means that they really are trying to end this war by starving the population into submission. So hunger is a weapon of war. It has been since day one, unfortunately.
How significant is the U.S.'s decision to not refuel Saudi Arabian warplanes as they launch airstrikes on Yemen?
I would say I will only believe it when it actually happens. I think there are a number of other factors that are contributing to this new kind of language vis-a-vis Mohammed bin Salman in particular. He's been killing dissidents left and right for a long time now. He's certainly been killing Yemeni civilians. So this is really not an issue of moral outrage from certain actors in the West. There's the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the United States in particular has changed because it's beginning to, its financial problems are beginning to affect its ability to pay for the weapons that it's buying in theory to fight this war. The fact that there's also been a public claim that there will be a ceasefire imposed by the United States in 30 days makes this also especially dangerous because it's one, it's offered a window of 30 days for the actors in this war to finally capture the asset that they're looking to capture in order to completely subdue the northern population. But more cynically still, the Pentagon, which is often at loggerheads with the Trump administration in this war, has made it quite clear to the congressional interests who want to stop this war that there are certain things that will not be affected by any kinds of operational changes vis-a-vis supplying fuel for Saudi airplanes. And something is actually revealed by Yahoo News several days ago, an operation called Yukon Journey, where American special forces that are on the ground now and who are dying and killing Yemenis as we speak are continuously seeking to change the conditions of the fight on behalf of the coalition against the Yemeni resistance. That will continue. So there are actually several layers to this public gesture to try to subdue what is beginning to become public outcry about this war. And in the meantime, ratchet up the violence to try to end this war on the side, at the favor of the American interests, which does not imply that Mohammed bin Salman actually is the victor, but it could mean a significant civilian costs, nevertheless.
Now, we hear even in the mainstream news that the U.S., you know, bears some responsibility, that the U.S. is standing by and allowing this to happen. But that implies that the U.S. has some power to stop this war rather than being cleared that the U.S. is part of this war. Isn't that an important difference, that complicity is one thing, but actually participation in the war is another thing? Is the U.S., would you say the U.S. is actively participating in this war?
Yes, I would not try to play along with the legal teams that are advising how to actually answer to questions such as these. They are without a doubt making this war possible. Without the men in the control rooms identifying targets and sending off airplanes to drop their what they call ordnances or their bombs onto targeted areas, it would not have been possible, this war. The supply of weapons themselves is clearly an indication of a direct investment. These kinds of weapons don't go into the hands of well-trained soldiers of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. They're going to service a largely mercenary army. The soldiers on the ground now inside Yemen are paid soldiers from Sudan or from Chad, some of whom are Australian and even United States mercenaries. On top of the fact that, as I mentioned before, there's an acknowledgement now that under this Operation Yukon Journey, American Special Forces are on the ground as well. So what's so interesting about this whole turn of events is that at some point several weeks ago, Donald Trump on one of his tours in the United States warned the King of Saudi Arabia that within 2 weeks, if the Americans stopped supporting the kingdom would fall. And that was, for me, I'm reading this as an overt demand that Saudi Arabia resolve whatever kind of political problems it has internally. This was, before the Khashoggi murder. And so things are happening rapidly behind the scenes, if you will. The insiders in Washington and London know that there is a dramatic change of heart, if you will. And it seems that the Pentagon, through their assets, and the CIA, through their assets, are trying to assure that this war ends in the way that they had long envisioned. Mm-hmm. Now, politically, it may not seem possible at this stage. And indeed, the fact that we now know that millions are starving to death, it makes this war even more necessary to end. But again, it seems the Pentagon will not allow this war to end, outside the terms that they had laid out in the first place.
Right. Did you see Senator Bernie Sanders' op-ed on Yemen, written October 24th in the New York Times, saying we must stop helping Saudi Arabia in Yemen. Congress needs to step in to end our complicity in the kingdom's human rights abuses. What do you make of this?
Again, 3 years too late. I'm not impressed by any of these public gestures of which are often used for domestic reasons as opposed to actually seeing through with actually stopping this war. And there are all kinds of legalisms in this that gives space for, again, these special operations to continue while the more public gesture of stopping overt support is, again, something that may be necessary at this stage. It's become politically a problem not only for those warmongering elements, but even those who claim in American public audience that they are always behind a rational way of using American power, which is often to avoid war against civilians. So again, I'm not impressed by the Democrats or Bernie Sanders' recent gestures until things are actually changed dramatically on the ground, until they actually spend more time in public saying what's actually happening in Yemen, we're going to unfortunately not see that much things changing on the ground.
Have there been enough public protests? I mean, certainly there's very little appetite among the American public for war these days. But the problem is, of course, it's not very much in our consciousness because we don't get very much media coverage. Those who I identify as anti-war activists have been speaking about the Yemen war, haven't they? And have been calling on the end of the war.
Well, this is, for me, living in Europe these days, it's for me quite astonishing to see how little public outcry there is, both in Europe and in North America. You will have maybe a dozen people standing up and taking pictures of themselves in front of the UN office in New York or in Geneva. You may see some well-meaning people in the front of the White House with a couple of placards, but it's nowhere near mass movements to demand change. There are some constituencies who may be writing and having campaigns to reach out to their representatives, but again, it's not an overwhelming demand for ending this war, the heavy investment in clouding what this war is about has really come to service the interests of those who are trying to pursue the destruction of Yemen, as I argue in my book. And so people are just entirely, one, confused or overwhelmed with the seeming complexity of this war, as well as they're not able to rhetorically get out of how simplistic the war has been presented as a war between Saudi Arabia and Iran, which is entirely false. But again, the narrative itself has helped undermine any kind of public resistance to what's happening in Yemen.
How would you distill Saudi Arabia's interest in devastating Yemen if it's not a proxy fight between the Saudis and Iranians?
First of all, the family, the relationship between Saudi Arabia and what I call empire, which we can narrow down or simplify to saying the United States and its European allies, is to assure that natural resources flow in certain directions. The profits from those natural resource sales go back into the Western economies, and the dollar remains the hegemonic currency of exchange, if you will. Now, those things can change dramatically in the last couple of years with the rise of the BRICS, and even though there's been some revisionist government, significant changes to this relationship in Brazil and elsewhere, there is still this structural process of transformation in the world that unfortunately implicates Yemen. And the fact that Saudi Arabia, until recently, has been the exclusive tool of empire in this region, it has been more or less burdened with the financial costs of this relationship. And the fact that the family itself is no longer has the financial means to just borrow money at infinitum to pay for the expensive weapons, to pay for its proxies throughout the Middle East and indeed the world, means that it has to secure the resources of Yemen in order to shore up its financial stability and long-term survival. And the fact that Yemenis have long resisted this, even though that there's been some occupation of Yemeni territory since the 1930s, this last effort, this last gambit to steal Yemen's resources has resulted in this drawn-out war.
Isn't Yemen the poorest nation in the Gulf Arab region, though? And, you know, geographically speaking, also not that big.
Geographically, it's quite large. If one thinks about South and North Yemen combined, it covers the entire southwest corner of Arabian Peninsula. It sits on top of probably the most lucrative and resource-rich area, geologically speaking, that connects the Horn of Africa with Arabia. But these are areas that have yet to be exploited.
I see.
Now, and Yemen has long been known, along with Somalia, it has this kind of storehouse of future exploitation possibilities. It's just that it was too expensive at the prices of oil at the time. And whether or not they have been producing large amounts of oil and oil wealth, but it goes to the small group of oligarchs who run the country. And so, much like Saudi Arabia, if you walk the streets of Jeddah, you see homeless people all over the place. The wealth is not distributed fairly. And by the way, being just returning to the Bay Area, I see lots of people on the streets of San Francisco and Berkeley. And that also is an indication of a wealthy country not distributing its resources very fairly. So Yemen is poor, but not resource poor. It is a very rich country, which has enormous potential with the right kind of political leadership. The fact that it's become somewhat of a country of facing civil war and destruction is an indication that there's been heavy investment in making sure Yemen could never develop in the directions that it had every right to.
I'm wondering, Issa, if you feel that the outrage over the killing of the Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi seemed to draw far more attention than the killings of thousands and thousands of Yemenis, these faceless, invisible folks or people who are made invisible here in the U.S. And as brutal as the Khashoggi killing was, if it weren't for Turkey making a political point out of it, even that wouldn't, you know, apparently have made much difference, it seems, to the West, to the Western allies of Saudi Arabia and those who are selling it arms and buying its oil.
Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic. This whole Khashoggi affair exposes the complexities to the West's relationship to the Middle East, because its allies are actually segmented and fragmented, and there are actually different factions within power circles in the U.S. in terms of their relationship with the Middle East. So you have a whole faction of political and strategic elites who are attached to Qatar, and by extension, Turkey these days, as opposed to those who had more traditional links to Saudi Arabia as the kind of principal ally in the Middle East. The fact after the Cold War that Qatar became the new instrument, if you will, for gaining influence through the Muslim Brotherhood organizations that had increasingly been responsible for creating the kind of social upheavals we saw associated with the Arab Spring, meant in the United States that you had two distinctive parties, if you will, supporting two different rival regimes in the Gulf. And this has played itself out in ugly ways in Yemen, with Qatar ultimately being pushed aside by the arrival of the Trump administration. But that has clearly begun to change as Trump's own foreign policies has been somewhat modified by the nature of the rivalry within American politics. So too has Saudi Arabia's last bit of opportunity to remain a key ally been pushed aside. Again, Khashoggi is one of many, many Saudi subjects who have been killed over the last 3.5 years, let alone the thousands and thousands of Yemenis and the millions who are now threatened by starvation. So we're not dealing with a moral outrage per se, we're dealing with actual structural power struggle within not only the Arabian Peninsula, but also in the circles of power in Washington and in London. So if we frame it in these terms, it becomes increasingly interesting how those behind the Washington Post and those behind, let's say, the factions in the neocon Clinton alliances that against Trump plays itself out in the Gulf as a pro-Qatari element that are now beginning to surface again as the ones dictating the direction of Middle East politics for the United States. So I would suggest listeners think about it in those terms moving forward.
Issa, does if you were to sort of able to distill demands that a mass movement in the West could launch to end the war in Yemen, would it include not just the U.S. withdrawing all support to Saudi Arabia in the war, but also a long-term cutting off of ties, stopping arms sales, etc., to Saudi Arabia?
For Yemenis, it would have to be a complete change of relationship with the Middle East entirely. Again, if Saudi Arabia loses out, that does not mean that Yemenis are in any ways safe from external influence. That just means Qatar, through their various assets, whether it be local, Tawakkul Karman, who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2012, was an extension of this very deep influence that American ambassadors, the Obama administration, and others have invested in through Qatar influence with the Muslim Brotherhood organization. So again, if Saudi Arabia vanishes, that doesn't mean that Yemenis are free from this danger. So Americans have to be vigilant about the nature of their politics vis-a-vis the Middle East and the larger Islamic world. And unfortunately, if one faction loses out, that doesn't mean that American empire ends its rather ugly relationship with regional proxies. It just means that one faction wins over another. The same applies to Israeli politics, right? I mean, you may have those who oppose Zionist colonialism, but does that necessarily change with one government taking power and one does not? There are all kinds of dynamics that are at play in the region that we need to be vigilant about, not to buy into this simple binary between the Saudis representing America's ugly side and everything else is America's good side of its relationship to the Middle East.
I want to thank you so much, Issa, for joining us today, for continuing to shine a light on this issue that doesn't get nearly enough attention. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Sanaa.
Issa Bloomi has been my guest. He's an associate professor in the Department of Asian, Middle Eastern, and Turkish Studies at Stockholm University. His latest book is called Destroying Yemen, What Chaos in Arabia Tells Us About the World. We've been discussing the latest in the U.S.-Saudi war on Yemen. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and now on Instagram at RU with Sonali.